Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. The price of solar panels has fallen in recent years, but installation is still expensive and time-intensive. Despite the cost, the University of Illinois is in the process of finalizing plans to build a 20-acre solar farm on campus. And some residents of downstate Illinois are starting to feed power into the grid with solar panels installed on their homes. Today on the program, we examine the future of solar energy in Illinois, and we do so with two guests. Ty Newell is an Urbana resident with an entirely solar-powered home who, along with his son, operates a solar energy engineering business called Build Equinox. He's also a retired University of Illinois professor of mechanical engineering. Ty Newell, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Also with us is Nick Hyla. He's executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. That's a nonprofit organization promoting renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable living. Nick Hyla, welcome to Focus.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. And as always, we welcome you to the conversation with any questions or comments you may have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach us via Facebook or Twitter. You can post comments on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online, or if you want to tweet us, our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Let's start with some basics. Ty, how does solar energy work exactly?
Well, there are so many different ways that it can be implemented, from the direct way that you'd think of, the sun shining on panels that are either heating water or air or some other substance, to the direct electromagnetic radiation of the sun moving into what we call photovoltaic panels and producing electricity. But then the other ways, through wind, through hydro, and then, of course, we're all dependent on solar energy to raise all the food that we consume. So a lot of different ways.
So I guess we tend not to think about it, but really solar energy is a key component in our lives, whether solar panels anywhere or not.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a small, tiny amount of what we're dependent on that's needed for, say, comfort and running a radio and things like that. For example, a 1-inch rainfall in Champaign County over a 24-hour period would take the equivalent of 1,000 nuclear power plants to vaporize water out in the oceans thousands of miles away and then transport it and condense it onto Champaign County.
Nick, theoretically, if we could figure out how to fully harness solar energy, could we someday power the entire world with the energy the sun provides?
Oh, absolutely. The amount of solar radiation that falls on even available roof space in the U.S. In particular could do that, and most of the large-scale installations, including the one that's going in near Champaign-Urbana, are ground-mount arrays, and so the available solar resource outstrips all of the other energy-producing technologies that we have, including natural gas, oil, coal, hydro, nuclear. So there's a lot of sun out there.
So then what are the hang-ups? What's keeping us from finding more ways to find practical applications for solar energy?
Well, the way I like to think about this, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association has been promoting this for 23 years, and so we've kind of seen the solar market cycle. And if you look at solar businesses from 10 years ago, they were what we call mom-and-pop shops that were design and installation companies for the most part, and they were serving customers that were early adopters, that were doing things despite the economics and doing them for their own reasons, whether that be security or environment, et cetera. And now we're in this phase of market penetration where, as you mentioned, the costs have come down. We're reaching the levelized cost of energy or energy parity with other fossil fuel sources of energy. And so solar is expanding. And, the real limitations, the first is education. People don't understand the financial benefits of solar or the fact that many of the components and many of the manufacturers in the U.S. have 25 to 30-year warranties. It's a very durable technology, no moving parts. And so I think the first battle is one of kind of education and promotion of solar. But beyond that, we are in a very strong innovation phase with solar, both in the technological sphere and that advancement, but mostly in the financing process. And we can talk more about that, but kind of in that, as solar deploys into the market, as people figure out how to finance it in different ways, we are engaging utilities and municipalities and inspectors and permitting offices and architects that have never seen or aren't really familiar with solar and the appropriate ways to deploy it. So it really is a giant educational effort that's needed to advance solar.
Ty, I recall one of the biggest hang-ups, mm-hmm. certainly you go back 20, 30 years, was this idea of, okay, first of all, the solar panels themselves were at that time expensive. They still mm-hmm. are reasonably expensive, but with that cost coming down. But the other big issue was, how do you store this energy that you build up? Because the sun's not always up in the sky.
Yeah, there's a lot
coming
of
down on you.
Yeah, there's and I also just want to mention, you know, Nick hit the nail on the head, education. There's a lot of bad information being spread by primarily competitors of renewable energy. But let me say, as far as these technological advances and storage and all that, these are getting solved as rapidly as the costs are coming down. A solar electric panel now is less per square foot than a window and much more efficient than a window. So if you're considering building a house and you're thinking you're going to put windows in, you should be thinking in terms of that's really a lot less economically viable than a solar panel.
Now, isn't it easier to see out of a window, though?
Well, here's a technological way that may not be so acceptable, but put a little webcam on the other side of that super insulated wall and hang a nice high-definition screen TV on the inside, and you've got a cost-effective solution. And if you don't like the way it looks outside your window, you know, put Hawaii on there or something like that. So, you know, so solar really, and all the arrows are going in the favorable directions. Efficiency is going up. Laboratories on campus here, our faculty are doing astounding things in technological advances in batteries, in the conversion technologies. To give you one example on storage, the labs over in material science have developed new electrodes that are just groundbreaking in charging and discharging batteries 10 to 100 times faster than what current battery technologies are capable of. And with those electrodes, when you pull into that station for a charge in an electric car, it's just going to be like a lightning bolt hitting your car. You won't have time to use the bathroom or get a cup of coffee. And so these barriers, now that we're concentrating on them, they're just falling by the wayside and in very cost-effective manners.
Nick, one of the impressions I get of how there maybe is a little bit of a shift in thinking in terms of how people can make use of solar energy is initially, when you think of those early adopters that we were talking about 20 years ago, their goal was to get off of the grid and install solar panels, power their homes independent of everything else, and not have to pay an electric bill to anybody. But the impression I'm getting is that there are some folks today maybe that are, they install solar panels, they're able to draw in some energy and then find a way to take that and send it off to utilities, and then in return they still receive power from those utilities, but sort of participate in the buildup of energy within the grid.
Absolutely. 99% of all solar that's installed in the United States is grid connected. So the market for these standalone or off-grid systems is small but important and actually growing also. And I think you've just highlighted one of the most interesting and one of our biggest priorities in market deployment is this net metering relationship with utilities. Utilities, and we could talk more about, you know, utilities and providing power, but in reality, when it comes to the economics of solar, it boils down to the relationship that the customer, the ratepayer, has with the utility and how the utility is going to purchase that solar power that they're producing from the utility, and how the utility is going to view that solar system as integrating into the transmission and distribution network. And, you know, in reality, net metering, and Illinois has a net metering policy, basically, at its simplest, says that the utility will pay you as a solar producer the same that you're paying them for electricity. So if you're paying on your electricity bill, you know, 11 cents a kilowatt hour, the utility will pay you 11 cents a kilowatt hour for the power that you produce. Now, you know, it gets complicated very fast. And kind of to dovetail a little bit on this technology conversation, a lot of the advancement of solar, once we reach a certain percentage of solar production in any given utility area, is going to depend on the ability of our grid to take that energy and use it. And that is also, you know, there are two issues that are involved in there. One, which we talked about, is storage. And many utilities across the country are looking at this neighborhood-level storage or community-level storage to help moderate the grid. And also the smart grid, understanding and being able to control loads, whether they be in businesses or houses, and to match those with the power generation. So the conversation of solar isn't complicated when you, say, have 0.01% of the energy on a grid being solar. But once you get up to that 2 to 5%, then it really becomes more of a conversation about how does solar integrate with the grid, and how does it integrate with not only the economic structure that the utilities have with the grid, but also that technology structure and regulatory structure.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the future of solar energy in Illinois on today's program. And my guests are Ty Newell. He's an Urbana resident with an entirely solar-powered home who has a solar energy engineering business. It's called Build Equinox. He's also a retired University of Illinois professor of mechanical engineering. Also with us is Nick Hyla, executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, a nonprofit promoting renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable living. We welcome your questions and comments about solar energy in the state of Illinois at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email any questions or comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So let's talk a little bit about technology. Ty, how do solar panels work exactly?
Well, for the solar photovoltaic, the solar to electrical conversion, basically the photons are banging into some electrons, and my friends over in physics and material science won't appreciate my explanation all that much. But basically, you know, they're knocking electrons through an electric circuit, and that electromagnetic energy goes in and does whatever you want in your house or into the grid, as Nick was mentioning, to help other people stay comfortable and happy.
And so they essentially convert sunlight into electricity.
Yeah, and there's a variety of materials and technologies that are rapidly, ones that are maturing and costs are coming down. I mean, you know, you can now buy large, you know, home scale solar systems from big box stores and at a cost that's less than the wholesale price that that I purchased our system for our house 3 years ago. And so now it really is getting in the mainstream, and it's a matter of education, as Nick said, to get the word out so people understand this is doable in any community now.
Nick, I mentioned at the top of today's show that President Carter first had solar panels installed at the White House back in the 70s. Much of the country at the time was, I guess, not very impressed. In fact, our next president, Ronald Reagan, had them removed. Are the solar panels we use today the same solar panels that President Carter had installed?
The way I want to answer that question is different than the truth. I mean, in reality, the solar electric modules, the hard crystalline modules, are substantially the same with improvements. So I think, in a way, what I would like your listeners to take away is that this technology is not new. It has been around for 60 years. What is new is the business framework, one, that, you know, we've worked hard over the last 25 years to really help ensure that these systems are appropriately installed, that they have warranties, and the business models continue to support this work, and the companies have in many ways improved upon what we call the balance of systems, the other technology that delivers that electricity from the modules to your electrical loads in your house and to the grid. So yes, in essence, the ones that are on the White House, the ones that are on the space station, these modules that are 20, 25 years old, they are substantially similar. But they're right now we have the installation and business model and warranty model and generally the mature market model to ensure that those products are more widely distributed.
Has there been any change tying the efficiency of
cells? There's gains in efficiency as well as Nick was saying, in the reliability. And these warranties are real warranties. I mean, these decades of experience that the panels have been out now, when you get a 20, 25-year warranty for solar panels, and I don't know anything else in my house that has that type of warranty, it's a real warranty backed by real companies. So, you know, the efficiency now, you know, 3 decades or so ago, we were at maybe 5% solar to electrical energy conversion. Now we're surpassing 20%. And in the laboratories and in advanced systems, they're hitting 50% solar to electrical conversion. And at the same time, the manufacturing efficiencies are improving, so the costs are tumbling down. So costs that were about $10 a watt just a few years ago, we're now seeing less than $1 a watt for the panels. And as Nick said, in balance of systems, somewhere in the range of maybe $3 a watt would be typical for what anybody could buy a system for.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking about the future of solar energy in Illinois with retired U of I mechanical engineering professor Ty Newell, who has a solar-powered home in Urbana. I want to ask you more details about that in just a couple of minutes. His family also has a solar energy engineering business called Built Equinox. Also with us is Nick Hyla, executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, a nonprofit promoting renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable living. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We're on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media, and the phone numbers again are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we'll start this morning with Paul in Champaign County. Hi, Paul.
Good morning again. I have a number of questions, and one is you've been talking about different ways of financing, but the one that I was curious about is where a company installs it and you don't really own it for a certain term. They sort of use your roof and your nearness to the, you know, the grid. And you will, supposedly, I think some of the ones include that you'll own it eventually. I don't know what that compares to the lifetime of the actual units, but that's something I wanted you to talk about, and I think you were getting there. But the other question I had is solar shingles. Whatever happened to that? I understand there were all sorts of lawsuits involved, and I talked to a guy at a home show about it, and he said, oh, it's just too complicated. But there was a company named Ovonix, and the idea is that you, instead of putting a unit on your roof, you just would get these shingles with the right kind of nails and connectors, and it seems to have blown up, and it seems a fairly elegant way of doing it if you can get enough gain.
All right, we'll talk about both of those topics. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
All right, and Nick, let me start with you. What about this initial idea that he was talking about, that sort of a rent-to-own almost kind of approach?
Right. We in the industry call it third-party purchasing. And as an example, in 2011, California installed as much solar as the rest of the nation combined, and over half of that solar that was installed was through these third-party purchase agreements. And I just saw yesterday that Colorado, which is in the middle of a solar boom, 80% of the solar that was installed in that state in 2012 was third-party purchasing. So this is becoming a very popular vehicle to finance solar. And the general concept is that, as you mentioned, people see solar as expensive. And in reality, that's because you're buying 25 to 30 to 40 years of power up front all at once. And once you install that solar system, the fuel is free. The fuel is the sun, so you're not buying natural gas or you're not paying for electricity. You're producing electricity from the sun, so you have to kind of buy that all up front. And so the financing models that are out there are really trying to tackle this question of how do you spread those costs out over time and make it more affordable for more people to access it. And that's really kind of on this residential and commercial side. Beyond that, you know, investors, which are on the other side of this equation, so you have the residents or the business that says, I want solar power, but I can't buy it up front. On the other side, you have an investor who isn't used to thinking about money the same way as a homeowner. They're thinking about their return on investment. So they look at all the investment vehicles out there and they say, you know, what's going to give me the best return on investment? Where's my money going to be safe? Well, in solar, as we mentioned, we have 25- and 30-year warranties for products. We have a really intelligent system monitoring, great trained installers out there, lots of good case studies, and we also have 50-plus years of climate data that can really very accurately over longer time frames predict the amount of power you're going to get. And then, and so those investors see solar as an incredible investment opportunity. Well, the third-party purchase agreements connect those two together, and they say, and an investor will come in, and based on your electric use and your utility rates, if the finances work out, they will install, they will pay for and own the solar system that's on your building. And usually the way that works is they guarantee you a lease rate, so a lease term of, say, 10 or 15 or 20 years, and you'll pay them a lease rate that's less than your power bill, than you were normally paying for your power bill. So they're giving you, say, 10 to 20% savings, and they own the system, and they're making some money by selling power back to the utility.
Are either of you familiar with the other part of his question, solar shingles or photovoltaics shingles?
Yeah, just as far as the shingles, you know, there's been a lot of work toward that. A place where you might take a look for more information if you do a web search on the Solar Decathlon, the Department of Energy's competition among 20 universities every other year, which the University of Illinois has been in three decathlons. But at the Solar Decathlon website, you'll see all the different components and systems that these student teams have implemented on these 100% solar-powered homes. And there has been a number of schools that have had the more recent versions of solar shingles. And they should have costs and different specifications on the websites that go with the Solar Decathlon. But, you know, the big problem has always been, how do you make something act as a roof and then also act as a solar panel and that has the same life and durability that each need? And then it, as you would snap them together or bus tie them together, that's also been a fairly difficult problem as you think of something shingle size and then the number of those that you might have on a roof. So the practical implementation has been a tricky part.
Let's go next to Jeff in Piatone. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, guys. Great topic. You know, this is kind of I work for a municipality, and I'm volunteer my time. And the one thing I know that is that a lot of these cities and towns aren't going to let people stick, you know, wind turbines or whatever up on the roof. And I know some cases you can't really even put solar panels up there because of codes, which is kind of a shame. I know this northern climate, though, it doesn't really, I mean, the lack of sun in the last month or so has been really, really bad up where I'm at anyway. You guys out of the south might be a little bit different, but big contrast. I actually grew up in the desert, and thousands of these things are all over, and you can see them for miles. You know, it's a good idea. Is it practical use right now? No. I think the development is there, and I think they're making it so a person can, you know, maybe make it a little bit more affordable. But you were saying it's, you know, 10, 12, 14 years down the road. Well, I got to tell you, half my block flips their houses so many times because of job transfers or something that I don't see a person living in their house more than maybe 7 to 10 years at most, if that. And you know, will you ever recoup the cost? No, I think it's got to come down considerably before the average Joe can use it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. Thanks for the call. That is one of the big questions, I imagine, if you're contemplating whether or not to install solar panels or do any kind of big investment, how long do you really expect to be in that home?
I think you hit two different issues there, one on the practical and economic feasibility, and then the second on the appraised value of homes, which, you know, as you're familiar with your activities, that homes get appraised on a dollar per square foot basis. And things like, well, at least in Illinois, things like extra insulation, a 50-year steel roof that can be recycled, things that add value and quality to a home do not show up as value on an appraisal form. And, of course, banks loan money based on that. So right now in Illinois, you put in solar panels, it's an asterisk on your appraisal form. It doesn't have value. And so you're right. If that value isn't added on to that house when you go to sell it, you don't recoup it. And so that needs to change. As far as technical feasibility, and if you go on our buildequinox.com website, you'll see under publications a series of articles that my son and I wrote for an engineering journal, but it's written for the general public on building a 100% solar-powered home, the different design considerations, and what goes into that. And one of the monthly articles covers solar costs. And these are not projected costs. These are not taken from studies. These are me as a general contractor building this house, hiring the trades that put the house together, and me writing checks from a checkbook or making draws from the bank on the construction loan. And so it's real costs. And what you'll find is that I'm in a house that costs the same as the other neighboring homes in subdivision in Urbana. It's fully inspected, past all the International Residential Code and building safety codes. And the main difference is I don't have a utility bill, and my neighbors spend $2,000 to $3,000 a year on their utilities. Now, my solar system for the house energy costs $20,000 installed, with a 20 to 25 year warranty. And so if it goes belly up in 20 to 25 years, my utility cost per year is about $1,000, or basically a cup of coffee a day is my average utility, even in this bitter cold weather that we're having right now. And then, as Nick was talking about with the grid tie type systems, I've already banked that energy during the summertime when the utility was really crying for extra power to meet its high demand. And right now I'm dovetailing in, and when they're looking for customers, and I'm using a bit extra as I have a deficit, but I've already banked that energy, and Illinois and basically all of the U.S. For sure, 100% solar power is economical and feasible.
Well, okay, let me dig in a little bit on the dollars that you just stated, just
sure.
For your example. So you said that most of your neighbors are spending about $2,000 a year, give or take, on energy. You're spending about $1,000 a year, right? You spend
100% electric home,
right? And you spend about $20,000 to install it,
right?
So that means for it to be cost effective for you, you need to stay in that home for about 20 years.
Well,
right?
To the
point where you've paid off
that $20,000 didn't add value to the house.
Right, which at the moment it doesn't.
Right, right.
Okay.
And California, it does, though. Okay. California, I mean, it's documented that divisions, subdivisions, new home divisions that have solar on it sell at a higher premium and sell faster than homes without.
But at the moment, Urbana is in Illinois, not in California.
That's exactly right.
So, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Beyond that, this is Nick. And,
yeah.
And beyond that, that's also assuming that the power prices aren't going to increase. And that's one of the real benefits of a solar system, is you're locking in the price that you're going to pay for electricity. And I can tell you right now, in both Illinois and Wisconsin, the delivered coal costs have been increasing between 10% and 13% every year. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, cheap natural gas. But that price has come out of the trough. The industry cannot sustain such low prices, and we're seeing that those prices increase also. And so, the smartest people in the room are still projecting costs increases for delivered power, fossil fuel power. And so I think, that's also to be considered. Beyond that, I think another point that was made is really, this idea of working with municipalities to make solar a reality. And municipalities really have two big tools that they can use to advance solar. The first is making it easier for folks like Ty and his customers to work with the municipalities to get their structural permits, their building permits, and get their electrical permits. And we as the MREA are working as part of this DOE SunShot initiative to help reduce what we're calling the soft costs, which is really related to permitting and inspection. And beyond that, municipalities all over the country are taking advantage of some financial models to really work and reduce their own cost of their buildings. We have public institutions and private all across the country that exist in very old, hard-to-heat buildings, and their utility costs tend to increase a lot, but their revenues don't. And solar presents a real option for those utilities, for those municipalities to help balance their budgets. And we can talk more about that if your listeners are interested.
We're discussing the future of solar energy on today's program with retired U of I professor Ty Newell. These days he's involved in a solar energy engineering business called Build Equinox, and he has a solar-powered home in Urbana. Also with us today is Nick Hyla, executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, a nonprofit organization promoting renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable living. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Soul food has warmed hearts and bodies for years, but now Byron Hurt, the producer of the documentary Soul Food Junkies, tells us we're finding major health risks associated with a soul food diet. Soul Food Junkies, our next community cinema screening, looks at how soul food may be causing more harm than good for those who eat it. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, January 15th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 guaranteed hand-knotted authentic Oriental and Persian rugs from new to antique that complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service, located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the future of solar energy in Illinois on today's program. My guests are Ty Newell, an Urbana resident with an entirely solar-powered home who has a solar energy engineering business called Build Equinox. He's a retired University of Illinois professor of mechanical engineering. Also with us is Nick Hyla, executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, a nonprofit promoting renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable living. To join our conversation on air, you can call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or again, you can post your comments to our Facebook or Twitter pages. We're on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online. Our Twitter handle's Will Public Media, and the phone numbers again are 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We have a question from Roana, who asks how difficult it would be to convert a 100-year-old house, colonial-style house, that is, to solar power. She says it seems like it would be far more difficult on the older houses than on a newer one. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah,
Tom?
For sure the retrofit market is where there's a lot of challenge, but also where a lot of opportunity. And just knowing that our newly constructed homes, those are easy to design correct from start. And our older homes, each one's going to be different from problems that it may have as you open it up in some manner and find deterioration that were costs you didn't expect and now have to treat along with, for that type of construction, what the best way is, whether you put, say, an exoshell, insulated shell on the outside of it to improve it, or interior, or you use something like a ground source heat pump that gives you advantages in the efficiency that you're cooling and heating the home. So there's a lot of challenges in what solutions are the most economical. And then, As in any of these questions, how do you finance it? Who's willing to give you money? What will be the payments for that? So that someone can afford those improvements.
So it's not just a matter of installing the solar panels. You have to think about, well, what kind of heating do I have? Is it geothermal? Is it something else?
Right. It's a puzzle. So for example, you have choices of the thicker you make insulation, the more the insulation is going to cost, but the less the energy you're going to use and its cost for then heating or cooling that home. But if you build a wall that's way too thick, now you're spending too much on insulation, even though your energy and associated costs have gone down. So what's the optimal balance of that?
Is the same thing true about solar panels themselves? Are there different sort of grades of quality of solar panels, and the more expensive ones draw in more energy and the less expensive ones draw in less? Or
there is, but they're pretty competitive. I mean, they're just like most industries, the dollar per watt, they know people are looking at that. Less efficient panels might require twice as much area, and so, but on a dollar per watt basis, maybe, you know, equivalent cost. Now, a less efficient panel would sound like who would want more roof area, but maybe that's a good thing if it's a shelter and you need a certain amount of roof, or if you're going to collect rainwater and that size roof is important for the rainwater resource harvesting.
What was the case with your home? Was it a newer home or an older home?
It's a brand new home. And so for sure there's cost efficiencies you gain by building smarter, by building higher quality. So the technology we used to build the home used what are called SIPS panels, structural insulated panels. And basically it's a styrofoam sandwich with OSB on inside and out that's both a structure and an insulation.
What is OSB?
OSB, oriented strand board, so a type of chipboard that you see used for sheathing and that on home construction. But with that type of panel, then there's very few seams to seal, and so you can get a very well-sealed home, which conventional construction, what we call fresh air, really is infiltrated air that comes through construction flaws. Like the sill plate around the foundation of your house where pesticides are being sprayed typically to keep the vermin out. Mm-hmm. Your fresh air in a conventional house is coming through these pathways that rodents and vermin come in, where a high-performance home, you would seal all those pathways, and then you bring what you know is fresh air into the home to keep it clean. And so you can do these other things that make it a much higher quality living environment at a lower cost.
Let's take another call. We have Ernie on the line from Champaign. Hi, Ernie.
Hi. There's an installation by the Old Men's Gym of a solar panel that operates the flashing lights for pedestrian crossing. Can you make a fairly complete run-through from the battery system and type of wiring and what have you? So that it sounds like something somebody can understand.
Mm-hmm. I can do that. Or, you know, basically, you know, that was one of the first incursions of solar panels, was replacing what would have been like a small gas or diesel generator that would have been powering like a sign like that. The cost of solar panels is... And electricity stored in a battery for that type of duty is about 20% of that when you run, say, an engine to then run a generator to produce that same electricity. And so that's why that made it into the market early on. But it's that same comparison as we think of solar-powered transportation and the new electric vehicles coming out, that an electric car like the Ford Focus Electric that that my wife and I have, it costs about 2 to 3 cents per mile of driving with solar-generated electricity from our house, versus about 12 to 13 cents a mile that's more typical with a gas engine car. And even though this car costs us $10,000 more than, say, the equivalent car with a gas engine in it, over 100,000 miles, we've saved $10,000 worth of fuel costs. And of course, it's much more important than that. That $10,000 that went into that manufacturing of that car, its batteries and associated systems, that went to Detroit and other places to manufacture the car. Instead of 60% of that $10,000 that would have gone to fuel, going across our borders and into other people's bank accounts that don't tend to like us very much. And so, you know, as you extend your view beyond it just being economical from my own checkbook standpoint, it's got significant implications on our own economy.
Let's take another call. We have Mark on the line from Champaign. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me. This is a very interesting conversation, and I really appreciate what you guys are talking about today. It seems from your guess that, you know, the solar panels are becoming more and more viable, more and more economical for, you know, let's face it, you know, relatively affluent people living in homeowners, living in suburban or ex-urban environments like Champaign. But really the question becomes, how do we take this model and apply it broadly? I'm thinking about urban environments, you know, cities, because, you know, I mean, your guest could correct me if I'm wrong, they know more about it than I do, but, I mean, it seems to me you could take, you know, the best solar panels available commercially today, you could put them on top of every single building, every single one in Manhattan, and on the clearest, longest day, you still wouldn't come close to meeting all of the energy demands of all of the businesses and people living in Manhattan. So how do we, you know, what's being done to try to overcome that problem? Because it seems to me, unless that problem is overcome, solar panels will remain a kind of small niche commodity, not unlike, you know, these really energy efficient light bulbs or energy efficient expensive refrigerators and dishwashing machines and so on. You know, I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks. All right, thanks very much for the call. Great question, Nick. What do you think?
That is a great question, and that kind of does get to the heart of what we call solar market penetration. And, you know, as a nonprofit, we think about this often. How do we get solar into the hands of people who actually need energy assistance? So I think that we'll leave that aside now and address kind of the central question of, you know, what can we do to give people that don't have a roof, for example, or people in the city access to clean power? And I'll kind of use an Illinois example. Right now, Illinois has an opportunity. Illinois has what's known as a renewable portfolio standard. And when a state has a renewable portfolio standard, they're basically providing a framework to say, so for example, in Illinois, the standard says that we will provide 25% of all of the electrons that go into how homes and businesses in Illinois will come from a clean energy source, a non-fossil fuel source. And of that 25%, they say we will have X amount from wind and X amount from solar. And including Illinois, they have a percent, 1%, that's specifically for distributed generation, which is people like Ty who have solar on their house and they're feeding into the meter. So they're on the opposite side of the meter from the utility and they're feeding, and that's called distributed generation. And in that framework, it provides this incentive for the utilities to develop clean energy. Now, it's true that the solar market has been very limited to the affluent, people who have the expendable income to go out and do this. There are models that allow folks to engage the utility. One is a Colorado model that's called Utility Solar Gardens. And in this model, the utility actually works with their ratepayers to develop a solar farm. So the ratepayers actually own, those who opt in, they actually own a small part of a large solar installation. There's a couple benefits of, and in general, these kind of models are called community shared solar, where instead of just me owning a system on my roof, that I and others in my area are pooling our money together to own a shared system. And there are a few really great benefits. The first is that utilities, we need to work with utilities. Our optimistic view is that utilities are good energy stewards or can be made that way. and their disposition is one of advancing technologies that make sense for their ratepayers. And if we operate on that kind of with that assumption, we can say, you know, utilities have a real interest in developing solar where they're using high-cost fuels, where they have congested transmission and distribution, and if they can leverage the involvement of their ratepayers to put solar in those spots, that both works for the utility and the ratepayers, and instead of each of those customers having to afford a solar system on their roof, and you can imagine the amount of labor and design and retrofit, et cetera, if they can all pool together and put one large ground mount installation in, they can save a significant amount of money. So there are models just like that that are helping make solar more affordable, and even municipal partnership models that we can talk about further if there's time.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, but I'll ask you to touch on those municipal partnerships right now just briefly if you could.
Sure. One, if anybody out there is interested, you can just Google the Morris model. And this comes from Morris County in New Jersey. And that model actually leverages the bonding authority of a municipality and access to, because of their good credit, access to low-interest bonds, and the tax credit and potential of these investor groups as third-party purchasers. And basically, it's a partnership between a development firm and a municipality that basically gets the most benefit out of the tax considerations given to these investment firms and the low interest rates of the municipality. And solar has really grown in New Jersey based on this model for municipalities. And beyond that, there's also Illinois has legalized property-assessed clean energy, or PACE financing, which allows a municipality to give low-interest or no-interest loans to residents and wrap the repayment for solar system deployment and wrap the repayment into the property tax, which solves that resale consideration for a house. Now, there's a problem on the federal level with, Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae.
Yeah.
But that's soon to be resolved.
Still, I wonder if the biggest bang for the buck when it comes to cities might have to do with larger corporations, institutions installing solar on a large scale versus individual homeowners or individual apartment complexes or what have you.
Yep, that's happening across the country. We see an incredible amount of installed capacity in these investor-owned solar farms that have long-term power purchase agreements with utilities. And, you know, we operate a program in Wisconsin, and hope we're working to bring it to Illinois, called Solar for Humanity, where we work with corporate partners to install solar systems on Habitat for Humanity homes. But that's more on this, on the corporate charitable giving side. So I wanted to put that out there that, you know, I think a lot of this, just as many good things that we do in this country, require giving. I think developing solar for those who need it most, you know, that kind of falls in that maybe it's not economic. Maybe it's more something that we consider as charitable.
Ty, do you see solar energy as, in the next 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, at some point becoming a primary source of our energy needs, or do you see it ultimately as a supplementary source that can be harnessed mm-hmm. a little bit more as time goes on, but maybe is never going to be, you know, we're not going to power the country or the world by solar?
No, it definitely will power everything. You know, as Nick said in the very beginning, there's so much more energy available through renewables than what we actually need. And in the case of my house, 600 square feet, I've got a 2,100 square foot ranch, so 600 square feet of roof space is enough to give me 8,000 to 10,000 miles of driving a year in an electric car, plus all of the energy in a modern house that's comfortable all year round. So there's just no doubt that we've got the energy to do everything, and it the benefits hit you in your pocketbook, in your local community. More trades are going to be involved in installing rainwater harvesting and solar panels. You're keeping more money on Main Street than in Wall Street with these technologies. And so
I would like to really thank Ty for his perspective. I totally agree. You know what, once we solve the storage problem, which I see being solved, you know, this becomes not a technological question, but one of social will. And mm-hmm. in reality, the reason that we have the utility generation system that we have, this heavily centralized fossil fuel-based system, is because we don't account for all the costs. And, you know, these are investor-owned models, and these investors make money off of the prospecting, off of the mining, off of the shipping, off of the burning, off the transmission and distribution, and equally, which is sad to think about, off of the contamination cleanup, off of the health effects, and all of those externalized costs are given to our state governments and given to our federal governments, and it's this type of economic system that gives us these public budget deficits that we have. And really, solar energy and this new model of distribution, generation distribution, really is part of a broader solution to tackle these problems. And I'm optimistic about that. We have the technology, and we have folks like Ty and many others across the country that see this clearly and are working to solve it.
That's Nick Hyla. He's executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, a nonprofit promoting renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable living. Nick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Great program.
And Ty Newell is an Urbana resident with an entirely solar-powered home, who with his son operates a solar energy engineering business called Build Equinox. He's also a retired University of Illinois professor of mechanical engineering. Ty Newell, thank you for talking with us as well.
It's been great to be with you, Craig.
We welcome any additional thoughts you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we will welcome back University of Illinois Professor of English and Linguistics, Dennis Barron. He has joined us from time to time through the years to discuss words and word usage, and we will specifically talk a bit about grammar pet peeves. We will welcome your least favorite instances of poor grammar usage, as well as other questions linguistic in nature. That's on tomorrow's show. Then on Thursday, Sandy Mason will be with us to take your lawn and garden care questions. Sandy's horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension. We'll talk a little bit about landscape design, something you can do in the winter months so that you can see the bones of the garden. We may also get into pruning practices and some other topics appropriate for the middle of winter. That's on Thursday's show. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.